Hello and welcome back to Politics and Polls. I'm Julian Zelizer, a professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University, and this is my co-host and colleague, Sam.
Hi, Sam Wong here, professor of neuroscience and molecular biology at Princeton, also co-founder of the Princeton Election Consortium.
So, Sam, we're recording this in the days that follow one of the largest protests in American history that came after the inauguration, which raised a host of issues about this administration, about gender rights, about reproductive rights and reproductive policy, all of which came together in Washington, all over the country. And for many who were on the streets and in the cars and in the trains, this was no ordinary election. We saw the victory of a now politician who consistently displayed hostility to women, to reproductive rights, who's working with a Republican Congress that has been waiting to roll back a lot of those rights and dismantle a lot of important policies. His vice president is a right-wing Republican who's been on the extreme end of the spectrum on issues like abortion and Planned Parenthood. Of course, that's Vice President Pence. And most important, as I said, he'll be working with a Republican Congress that's moved very rightward on these issues. Sam and I are honored to have with us one of the most distinguished thinkers on this subject, Katha Pollitt, a columnist for The Nation. She writes a regular column since 1996, and she's been with the magazine since 1980. She's often called the place to go for the best writing from the left. She's also published a number of books, including Reasonable Creatures, Subject to Debate, and Virginity of Death. One of the pieces from her book, Learning to Drive and Other Life Stories, was made into a film with Ben Kingsley, and she's also written for many other publications, including The New Yorker, The Atlantic, The New Republic, and much, much more. So, Katha, welcome to our show. It's a real honor to have you.
Oh, thanks so much for having me. Just to say one thing, though, I've only been writing my column since 1996. It's not that
okay.
antiquated.
Should I record? I'll fix that at the end. So welcome to our show. We wanted to start by discussing your new article that came out this week in The Nation. The Women's March succeeded because it spoke to women's outrage. And you really put together an interesting piece about this phenomenal outpouring and your own thoughts about how the protest was put together, some of your initial questions or skepticism, and ultimately your own experience and thoughts about how this all went down and what the impact is going to be. And so maybe we could start by just hearing a little bit more about what you're trying to convey in the piece.
Well, the first problem I had was with those pussy hats. When this idea came up in a feminist list I'm on, we had a huge dust up. Because there were people who thought it was, how shall I say this, it was provocative and fun and made a great feminist statement. And then there were people who tended to be of the older persuasion who thought it was too girly and basically was saying, oh, men like us. Look, I'm wearing a vagina on my head. But I came totally around. I was so wrong. It really made me think, you know, you have to reach out a little bit and just admit that sometimes other people have a good idea. Not everybody is a gloomy New Yorker from the Upper West Side who wears black all the time, like the Night's Watch and Game of Thrones. And the pussy hats were wonderful, and they did exactly what they were supposed to do, which was they provided a unifying visual statement so that you could just look at these crowds, and everybody looked like they were together, they were mobilized, they were on target about the same things. It was really great, and I wanted one so much that the woman I was standing next to gave me one.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, they were fun. They looked fun.
They did look like fun. In fact, I'm still wearing my pussy hat every day.
Are you wearing it now?
Not right this minute.
Oh, okay. Well, it's radio. It's a podcast, so it wouldn't really.
Right. Well, that's what I figured. But anyway, I thought the march was fantastic. And it was, first of all, it was enormous. And that, you know, it was started by women who were total amateurs. They just put something up on Facebook, like, don't you think we should all be marching on the night of the election? And 10,000 people signed up for it. And then eventually they had to get some professional organizers in, which was a good thing. But in 11 weeks, the organizers put together this fantastic, huge march that had branches in 500 cities around the world, including my husband was in Budapest. There was a march in Budapest.
Really?
Yeah, there was a march in Antarctica. There were a lot of marches in red states.
I guess it's daytime there, so you could have a really long march in Antarctica.
You could have a very long march, okay. Yeah. But you wouldn't want to stand out in the cold for too long,
no.
I guess. But anyway, it was a triumphant success, and I was so happy to see that. And I think it's what everybody needed because, you know, I don't know about you, but after Election Day, I was profoundly depressed. I just saw everything falling apart, everything I had worked for my whole life, everything I had believed in, and that's pretty depressing. And you just think about all the people who are going to suffer greatly, of whom I won't be one, but, you know, losing their health care, losing their little bit of Social Security, making abortion illegal or very, you know, even harder to get. All kinds of nonsense is going to happen and is already happening. And I just thought, well, what can you do? We're really stuck. And then this march reminded me that, no, we have a lot of people power. The future is not already written, and we can do this.
Well, the tension there is that, on the one hand, Republicans are now dominant in Congress. They held the White House. There's pretty strong dominance by Republicans at the level of state and local government.
Yes.
And yet, 3 million people more voted for Hillary Clinton than for Donald Trump. And so that's the contradiction. And so presumably that would be upsetting. And some kind of response to that, as you described, took the form of this organically growing protest.
Yes. Well, that is the thing. And I wrote in a recent column about, you know, just speaking about the reproductive rights movement, that we now have, I think, a movement that is better than it has ever been. It's more grassroots. It's got lots of young people with creative ideas. It's much more intersectional. It's branched out to, you know, reproductive justice, the growing framework. It's not exactly new, but we think of it as new because it's becoming more popular, where abortion rights and birth control rights are tied to being able to have a baby if you want one and being able to raise that child well. So it's tied in with issues of poverty and healthcare generally and so on, and racism and so on. And just as we get this fantastic movement with these great organizers, the anti-choice people take state power. So, I mean, that's a big thing.
So I was present at the Women's March in Oakland, and there was a series of speakers, and one thing that struck me was that one of the most politically convincing speakers was a representative from Planned Parenthood, and she went to some efforts to talk about women's health that was helped by Planned Parenthood, and she kept off of abortion a bit. I mean, she didn't really shy away from it, but she just pointed out all the things that Planned Parenthood does and the hundreds of thousands of women who receive health care through Planned Parenthood. And that struck me as a very politically savvy move on her part to broaden the discussion to these other topics.
Yeah, something like 1 in 5 women have visited a Planned Parenthood clinic. More than half, maybe as much as 3/4, are low income. And there are many places in the country where the Planned Parenthood clinic, that's it. That's what basic health care is. So they keep pointing, and the Planned Parenthood likes to point out that only 3% of their work is abortion provision. But, you know, I'm not so keen on making too much of that fact because, first of all, if you believe that abortion is killing a baby, how would you feel if someone said, well, only 3% of our work is killing children? You know, that wouldn't make you feel more positive about it. Or you could flip it around and say, okay, then we'll keep the other 97%, just give up the 3%. And you'll remember Donald Trump said during the campaign, he says, oh, no, Planned Parenthood does great work. It's just the abortion that's the problem. But now we're going to see Planned Parenthood defunded by our reactionary Congress. And what that means is that it loses over $500 million a year in Medicaid funding. That's what the funding is. It's not like the government just gives Planned Parenthood $500 million. It's that you can use your Medicaid to get care there. And now you won't have that choice to use your Medicaid in that way. So, and that's going to be really, really affect people in a terrible, terrible way.
I want to turn back to the specific policy threats that exist, but given the risks that are on the table now and the significance of this election, one of the things that you talk about in the article is how a lot of the press coverage in the lead up to the protests and even after the protests was incredibly skeptical about the march, about its impact, about how it was taking place. Why was so much of the media in some ways missing the enormity of this, or not missing it, but still very skeptical about its significance?
Well, I think to some extent that's the way everything about feminism is always covered. It's always covered in this slightly snarky, humorous way where feminism is supposed to be something that has no content. It's like, if it has any content, that's too much. That's called being, you know, exclusionary. It's supposed to be, you know, just girls together, women together. You go, girl. And if it has any content at all, then that's made to seem like, you know, Stalin is around the corner. So I think that's part of it. And also, I think, you know, feminism is something that everybody has a relation to, unlike some other issues. Probably there are infights and important disputes in every social movement, but we don't hear about them so much because people don't care that much. Or they don't have that, you know, I'm a woman, I get to have an opinion, or I'm a man, I get to have an opinion thing. And so I think that that is one reason why feminism is always, it's always up for debate and up for dispute, and it can be very irritating. For example, I mean, the New York Times ran story after story about, oh, are they, you know, the organizers are fighting, and what is feminism anyway? And then they went to Montclair, New Jersey, which is apparently a place they visit often to check in on real America.
They live there.
It's a relatively convenient real America location from
New York City. They live there.
And they live, a lot of the reporters right, live there, I understand. And so they wrote a story about how men, because their wives were off at the march, the men on that whole long, long Saturday had to take care of the children all by themselves. Oh, my God, you know, and we're so used to the kind of middle class framing, those of us in the middle class, that it took a tweet, I think it was, from a black woman who said, you know, single black women take care of their children alone all the time while working. And, you know, nobody writes an article about that. But, you know, that these men, one said, oh, and I had to clean out the refrigerator. Oh, no.
Yeah, that does seem a little bit lifestyle-y. So what about the idea? I think it seems to me that one difficulty here is that the march is for issues that are considered women's issues, but healthcare is something that is not. It is a general issue that in this case, women have taken, you know, these women have taken the lead on. At the same time, half the population of the United States is not monolithic. And so then you have, I don't know, women who are Trump supporters who are pretty vocal about that. And so I think it seems to me that one challenge here is that these are universal issues that these women have taken the lead on, these 2 million people, right? But at the same time, there is no case in which 50% of the population can be monolithic. So how does one square that?
Well, I think it was more than 2 million. I think it was at least 3.5 million.
Sure, it was at least 2 million. But like, it's between 2 and 4 million.
You know,
it was a lot.
Supporting woman wants to come forward with her plan for health care, fine. I mean, you had people in the Tea Party saying, you know, oh, I remember when my father, the doctor, was paid with chickens by his grateful patients. I mean, I don't think they have a plan. And in that vacuum, you're going to have people who say, look, this is what women need. There's always been that. I mean, there have always been women who are against women's liberation or any advancement for women. There were women who were against giving women the vote, women who were against women going to college, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, ISIS has women in it, and there are always men that, you know, want to have an opinion too. And there were lots of men at the march, I'm happy to say, probably around, I don't know, 30% of people have been saying that, which looked like, that's what it looked like to me down
and you
in
said,
Washington.
In your piece, you said some of them were wearing pink hats.
Yes, they did. They right. did. So I think naturally there are going to be people who oppose this, but, you know, let them do their best. What can I say?
So I wanted to turn to some of the issues that were on the table at the protest and issues that you've been writing about for a while in the lead up to the election and obviously since the election took place. And you had one article, What We Know So Far, where you point to two things. One is this disconnect that exists between where public opinion is on reproductive rights and where Republican lawmakers are. And then you talk about the various issues where the Republican Congress, regardless of public opinion, intends to go. And I was hoping you could walk us through some of the big programs, maybe three of the big programs that you think are most vulnerable, most at risk, given the new political configuration that we're watching.
Sure. Well, the first, of course, is the repealing of the Affordable Care Act, and specifically the getting rid of the no copay reproductive health part of it, where you can now get millions of women are now getting their birth control with, I don't want to say free because insurance is not free, but they're getting it with no copay. This has made an enormous difference to millions of women. And one way it's made a really big difference is that you can now get, if you're lucky, I mean, not all doctors are up to speed on this, but you should be able to get an IUD with no copay. And that's the very, very most effective form of birth control. And it lasts for, depending on the model, 3, 5, or 10 years. So if you have to lay out the money for an IUD, it would cost you maybe $1,000. And that makes a huge, huge difference. So that's, you know, let's get rid of that. Mm-hmm. And then the next thing they want to do is this making the Hyde Amendment permanent. Now, the Hyde Amendment has to be passed every year. So there's always the hope that one year it won't be passed again. And women.
The math nerd wants to be reminded about exactly what's in the Hyde Amendment.
Yeah, the Hyde Amendment says that federal Medicaid funds cannot be used to pay for abortions for women on Medicaid. There are some states, like New York State, that use state Medicaid funds to pay for low-income women's abortions, but most states don't do that. So it's made a huge difference in access to abortion, because an abortion costs quite a bit of money. It costs $500 for a first trimester abortion and may cost more depending on how the states have sort of loaded up unnecessary and extra services onto it. And so it's a big stumbling block for low-income women. So anyway, the Congress now, the Republicans in Congress now want to make the Hyde Amendment permanent law. So that would be very, very terrible. And another thing they want to do, of course, is defund Planned Parenthood. So defunding Planned Parenthood, we've talked about that. That would be a real disaster for lots and lots of low-income women and lots of women who live in places where they don't have access to other reproductive health care. And then another thing they want to do is this 20-week ban, this pain-capable unborn child protection act, which is to ban abortions after 20 weeks on the theory that nobody but they themselves believe that a fetus at that age can experience pain. So that what that means, the reason that's important, although it's a very tiny number of women who have abortions that late, it's mostly women who get a bad result on the 20-week ultrasound, or women who have been prevented one way or the other from having an abortion earlier. It's not like there are people just idling about saying, oh, well, it's time for my abortion. I'm, you know, five months pregnant. These are pretty serious issues, and it's only 1.5% of all women who have abortions.
And just to
them then. But they're very serious because there are important medical issues around them.
And just to bring into perspective, I am often hearing about government funding for Planned Parenthood without a piece of context that I just learned, which is that we talk about $500 million in government funding to Planned Parenthood. Their annual revenue combined is $1.3 billion, which includes that $500 million. So we're talking about over one-third of their annual budget comes from the federal government. And so losing that government funding would be basically around a 35 or 40% budget cut for Planned Parenthood because of Medicaid payments.
Yes. So it's very serious. And, you know, you can imagine that what might happen would be that Planned Parenthood would have to close some facilities, some clinics, and that would be ones that are in the poorest places, where the most people rely on Medicaid to go there. And I do want to say, you know, that we were talking before about the amount of services that abortion consists of it at Planned Parenthood. There are plenty of Planned Parenthood clinics that don't perform abortions at all. So this is really an attack that goes much farther than abortion. It certainly includes birth control. And I think the general indifference to women's well-being and women's reproductive health care is just pretty obvious.
Do you think so the article you wrote, the other striking part was just where the public opinion is in a very different place on these issues than where the Republican Congress is. And on some issues right now, there's an argument that as Republicans actually implement some of the programs, some people say this with Medicaid enrollment, for example, that there'll be such a backlash that they'll back away. Do you think that might be a dynamic, or is this issue different? Is it so ideologically driven, or are Republicans in such a place that they don't care about that? How will this public opinion discrepancy work, do you think?
Well, I think it'll work differently in different places. You know, we talk about the sleeping giant of pro-choice voters, that, you know, there's an enormous constituency for reproductive rights and reproductive health care that tends to be a little passive when it comes to actually doing anything about this, whereas the anti-abortion people are extremely motivated because they're trying to change the status quo. So when the status quo changes, it may be that the energy shifts to the other side. But I think one problem is that the most anti-choice things happen in the most anti-choice places. It's not like there's a national, a national smoothness of view. There are places that are a lot more anti-choice than others. And that means that someone who lives in a pro-choice place, like, say, New York City, has to care a lot about what happens in Missouri, a place they may never have been to. So it's a big country. But now that the federal government is going to be making laws about this for everybody, I think that might wake up the pro-choice majority, because it won't be so easy to say, oh, yeah, well, North Dakota, that's just very far away.
But the difficulty there is one of polarization between the parties on a number of other issues. So here's one issue that matters quite a lot to many people, but it's one of a basket of issues where the two parties have become separated from one another, where you can be in favor of the Affordable Care Act as a separate object from, say, women's access to health care, and you can be in favor of civil rights for persons of color, or you can have a certain view about scientific research or vaccine safety. These are all things that are separate from one another. So one difficulty it strikes me is that there could be a lot of energy for this issue, but as voters have become more polarized, it's one of a number of issues, and it seems to me that what you're describing mainly matters for people for whom that's the most important issue. So how does that get turned into electoral success, given that without taking anything away from this issue, how does one turn it into success when it's one of a number of issues that separate people into camps?
Well, don't these issues tend to kind of get bundled together in candidates themselves?
They do, but we had a really super interesting guest on some number of weeks ago was an Eric Schickler who's written about the history of parties, where the parties have become highly coherent. And you're right about that they've become coherent. Say, if you're in favor of the Affordable Care Act, then you are also in favor of civil rights for persons of color. These are things that go together now. And so they've become more consistent. But it is also the case that there are voters who say things like, look, I could be a Democrat, but I just can't because of the abortion issue. And there are certainly voters like that as well. I'm just trying to figure out to what extent these things can be separated from one another, or whether this is a strongly, you know, I'm understanding your point is that being that this is a strong enough issue that people who are pro-choice will come out of the woodwork and become active in ways that they hadn't before. And I'm just trying to nose into that a little bit and try to understand how that would actually work.
Well, I think there probably are people who say, yes, I would be a Democrat if it weren't for the Democratic Party's pro-choice positions. But I wonder if we talked to them more, we would find out that that wasn't so true. For example, one of the problems at the march was some anti-choice groups wanted to be listed as sponsors of the march, which was a pro-choice march. And so there was a moment when they were on the website and then they were taken off the website. And, you know, they say, okay, we're feminists, except for this one thing. But leaving aside the question of whether they were feminists except for this one thing, one of their leaders voted for Trump, you know. So I just wonder how many
that would be dissonant from the march.
That was
right. Didn't fit the theme.
Yeah. So I think people sort of might say, oh, yeah, it's the only thing. But if you talk to them for longer, you might find out there were other things. But let's say there are some people who would say, yes, I am, except for pro-choice, I would vote Democrat. Well, I think we have to try to persuade them that there are many, many other issues that they are, when they vote Republican, they are voting for a lot of really terrible stuff, and they need that it has nothing to do with life or being pro-life. It's all pro-death and pro-misery, and that they should think about that some more.
Why do you think, Kathy, you said that the success of the marches should put a rest to the identity politics argument, or critique of identity politics, although I think you then said it probably won't. But why did you say that?
Well, I said that because this was a march with a specifically feminist, woman-centered perspective that welcomed everybody, and there were lots of men there, and trans people, and gender questioning people there. But it was woman led, and it was led actually by women of color, and which is really a great and new thing. And I think that what the success of the march showed is that identity politics, what is called identity politics, I would never call it that myself, but woman-centered politics is a very powerful motivator for women. You know, I know Jonathan Chait thought it should just be called the March Against Trump. Well, who would show up for that? Some people would, but you wouldn't get people saying, you know, the day after the election saying, I have got to be there. I'm getting my plane ticket now because that groper is president. I mean, there was such an insult to women in the election of Trump, and it was very passionately felt. And I think that it was felt more deeply by women than by a lot of men, more personally, that's what I'm saying. And the idea that you can get rid of those personal feelings in politics, that personal stake, is something that only gets mobilized when it's about women or black people. You know, nobody says, hey, Italians, we should never appeal to Italians, Italian Americans, to vote for an Italian congressman. Of course not. That's the whole way, you know, New York City politics was organized around that, around Jews, Italians, and Irish. It's always been that way. When it's ethnic, nobody cares. When it's gender or race, then you're told that you should sit down and let the white men take over.
So the advantage here is that it has the sound of specificity because it's a concrete issue that people can put their minds around, namely treatment of women at the hands of the current president. And so it has that quality of specificity, yet it's broad enough that it encompasses slightly over 50% of the population. And so it's got that going for it.
It definitely does. And all the people who care about the 51%, which is...
Yeah.
Maybe not 49%, but a lot of that, 49%.
Generally, it is the case that people are hard to motivate with general calls to justice and general calls to principle. But once you make it specific, where it's your mom or your wife or your daughter, then that becomes very specific. So that's interesting because it actually hits the same point as what people say about feminism being very specific. And I hesitate to call it a boutique issue, but there's something about feminism that is regarded as very specific. And here, this is a case where that specificity, in fact, becomes powerful.
Well, you know, feminists have been trying for years to make the point that feminism, as bell hooks, the title of one of her books, Feminism is for Everybody, that, you know, feminism will change, women's equality will change a lot of things about American life, and it will take away some privileges from men, but it will also give men a lot. And a lot of men see that. You know, they see that it's really good not to have to be the sole provider, not to have to be strong every minute, not to have to dominate, not to have to fight with other men all the time, you know? And think of all the men you probably know who have no friends. They have no friends. Or if they have friends, they have women friends because there's too much competition for them to have a real friendship with a man. So, you know, feminism offers a lot to men, but it's a little harder to see than the benefits men get from sexism.
It's not, I mean, it's not unlike the civil rights movement in the early 60s. I was thinking of the March of 63, in that although that was a march for a narrower group of Americans, a minority of Americans, the principles were broadened by 1963. So they were principles that many people could believe in. It could create umbrella coalitions, which it did, from labor movement officials and activists to religious groups. And that's why, you know, King famously is standing in front of Lincoln as he delivers some of this and invoking American tradition. And it was also the civil rights movement was an attack on Southern Dixiecrats, even though that's not what it was really about. So it reminded me a little, the march was an attack on Donald Trump. It was an attack on this set of policies and this new political configuration without saying it. And I think in some ways that creates an ability to attract more people in the same way civil rights did. Civil rights was about Southern Dixiecrats. It was about this system of racial apartheid. But I think you can. There is a comparison to be made, even though the population is obviously much broader in terms of who we're talking about right now.
Yeah, I want to say one more thing, though, which is that I think women didn't just go because Trump is so gross and sexist and is actually the molester in chief. I mean, is confessed to being a molester and an assaulter and a harasser. I think the threat to reproductive rights was a lot of it. And I think just the general sense that, okay, we're going to clamp down on women. Women, you know, you've gotten out of your place. We're going to put you back there. And I think it was so sad. In one of these articles in the New York Times, they went to Niles, Michigan, and where there was nothing going on in this small town on the day. And one woman said, "Well, I don't think my husband would approve. He voted for Trump." And I'm thinking, "Oh, sister, you need a divorce."
One of my favorite signs that I read about were there was one sign that said, "Free Melania."
Free Melania, yeah. Well, I don't know. There's a thing going around on Twitter today which has Melania on The View defending birtherism. So she's
really?
She's not, you know, she's not an unwilling captive, I think. She's drunk her husband's Kool-Aid. But yeah, you do sort of feel like, how can she be doing this?
So how does this get turned into? So Julian was just talking about the civil rights movement. On an event like this where there are around 3 million people who show up, many of whom who have not turned out before, how does that get converted into long-term action? How is that going to turn into something that happens afterwards?
Well, this is the big question, isn't it? And already, you know, the people who like to be really gloomy are saying, oh, this is all going to, nothing's going to come of this. And there's a guy who wrote in The Guardian who said he was one of the organizers of Occupy Wall Street, says, oh, this is going to fade away just the way Occupy did. And I'm thinking, no. You know why? Because our movement doesn't ask people to sleep in a public park. You know, the buy-in is quite low, whereas for Occupy it was very high. But and our movement is not against electoral politics. It's not a structuralist movement. We're not anarchists. We don't have to say everything twice. you know, because we can't use a microphone. But I do think that it is a real question, what will happen now? And already people are talking, well, you've probably gotten, and your listeners too, have probably gotten emails about, here's the action of the day, here's something you can do, here's what you should be calling your congresspeople about. There are plans to have another demonstration on Income Tax Day to protest Donald Trump not revealing it, not releasing his taxes. So that's another cause that people can get really energized about, because we all have to pay taxes, and our tax, you know, every politician who's run for president has released their taxes except for him. And it just keys into all this unease I think people feel about his business dealings, about Russia, about his kids. About the way he stiffs people that work for him. So I think that's a great idea. But I think another thing that's going to happen is a lot more activism on the local level, a lot more people joining liberal and left-wing groups. And, for example, the ACLU and Planned Parenthood have both gotten a ton of donations, which is really fantastic. So I think people are looking around thinking, yes, that march was great. Now what?
Yeah.
Now what?
Julian and I were talking previously about the energy coming back on the Amtrak that Julian encountered on the train, and right, comparing it with Tea Party energy, which could have been AstroTurf, could have been fake activism. At least some people on the left called it that. But the Tea Party was composed of actual people who were fired up.
Yeah, I was on a train from Washington, and everyone was coming back from the protest. This was the day after the protest, and it was unbelievable. Different generations, different genders. They were talking about the events they saw. They were talking about politics. They were talking about what do you do next. And it was an intensity that I told Sam I had only seen on another train I took, which happened to be a train where a lot of Tea Party people were in 2009 before a big rally in Washington. So it's not a great way to measure things, but it felt that something was happening, as you've said, and something bigger could clearly come of this.
Well, the Indivisible Movement, in fact, makes an explicit comparison between current outrage and
But then there's still President Trump. And after the election, you wrote a piece where you said women lost, misogyny beat feminism. And he is in charge. His public attitudes and his demeanor matter. He's president. So for many Americans, they'll watch what he does. They'll watch what he says. They'll watch everything that we have seen on the campaign trail. And I guess what kind of damage will this cause, not just policy, but in terms of his entire attitude about women, about issues of gender? I'm curious, what are your fears about what he will do beyond the policies we've discussed?
Well, I think that there has to be a kind of normalization of Trumpish behavior when the president is doing it. I mean, that's what's so shocking. I mean, a lot of women, a lot of parents were saying, you know, what am I supposed to tell my child now?
Right.
You know, just do well in school, be a good person, be honorable, be kind. And when the president can be none of those things. So I think that there have been more hate incidents around the country. There are stories of, you know, people telling school children saying, you know, to black kids, you'll have to go back to Africa, you'll have to go back to Mexico. There have been, you know, all kinds of horrible reports that, you know, I hope are just anecdotal and don't represent some larger thing. But I fear that they do. I fear that they do. There were a lot of studies of Trump voters and their attitudes. And one study seemed to show that the biggest predictor of Trump voting was what they called hostile sexism, where you would answer yes to questions like, you know, women have all the power now, and women just get what they want by manipulating men, stuff like that. Those people were Trump supporters. That's not good. They already have the wrong attitudes, and now they feel justified.
Well, there is a sense, and there's a wing of Republican voters where one strong correlate of voting Republican is what's an authoritarian streak, loving authority for its own sake, loving a strong figure to come in. And so even though personalities in the United States are not monolithic, and even though these may not be things that people voted for, once they get a leader of that type, then that those ideas become part of the central conversation, and they become what's considered normal. And so now we have a national figure for whom these statements are part of the national conversation. And so now we're committed to that for at least for a while anyway.
Yes. Well, I think the attraction to the strongman personality is something that we're seeing in a lot of democracies, aren't we? It's a very troubling and discouraging feature. It really makes you wonder, because the Trump phenomenon is happening in other places too. His friend Putin, Turkey, they're big anti-immigrant, right-wing, strongman-type parties in many European countries, sometimes strong women like Marine Le Pen. And it's there's just a lot of this. It's very troubling.
I think you've captured in some ways both sides of where things are. And as you did in that article about reproductive rights, on the one hand, it's a very dire moment, both because of some of the values that come from the president on these issues and the real policy threats that are now on the table without any question. And on the other hand, there was the march, which was really significant and meant something, as you've written, and suggests that public opinion might be in a different place, and politically that there is a potential for a counter mobilization to some of these trends that you've been talking about. Unfortunately, we're out of time, though. So we want to say thanks to you, Katha Pollitt, a wonderful columnist for The Nation, for joining us today to discuss these issues.
Thanks so much for having me. It was a fun discussion.
Well, that wraps up our episode. So thanks for joining us, and we'll be back soon on Politics and Polls.
Thanks, everybody. Take care.
You've been listening to Politics and Polls, a podcast series about the 2016 presidential election produced by WooCast. The content discussed in this podcast is intended to be informational only. It does not represent nor reflect the views of Princeton University or the Woodrow Wilson School of Public and International Affairs.